This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have four guests. We'll speak first with Jim Petras on his new book, The End of the Republic and the Delusion of Empire. Then with Ajamu Baraka on the Black Lives Matter movement. Then we'll go to Cleveland, Ohio, where we speak with journalist Arun Gupta, reporting from the streets of Cleveland. And last, we'll speak with National Lawyers Guild legal worker Chris Hermes on the legal scene at the convention. Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Are we approaching peak America, where the Republic has failed and the empire, which put paid to it, cannot be achieved? For the first time, the goal of socialism has been raised in the presidential primaries, backed by tens of millions of voters. Not since the New Deal, nearly a century ago, have class relations come into sharper confrontation. The U.S. presidential elections are everything abnormal, with both major parties arousing popular revulsion. Not since World War II have the U.S. and Russia drawn closer to the possibility of mutual annihilation through nuclear war due to U.S. empire building. Who rules America and who sets the military agenda in the most contentious regions of the Middle East is an open dispute. We speak with Professor Petras about his just-released book, The End of the Republic and the Delusion of Empire. Professor Petras is the author of 68 books, published in 29 languages, and over 560 articles in professional journals. It's a pleasure to welcome Professor Petras back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for the invitation, Michael.
Well, Jim, The End of the Republic and the Delusion of Empire, your brand new book, which I've just completed, is really super. And I wanted to congratulate you on the hard work that you put in to putting this out for all of us. And let me start off by asking you a question that I think we all have to grapple with, and that's the question of neoliberalism. You know, what is neoliberalism? Barack Obama and both Bill and Hillary Clinton define themselves as neoliberals, and you say that the ideas of neoliberalism and what they've done has brought us to the brink of a near catastrophe. Could you talk about that, please?
Yes. Let me just make a brief introduction to it. Liberalism originally was an effort to break down constraints on markets, production, and the trade, and that was against the traditional orders in 19th century. And neoliberalism is, on the other hand, a break with Keynesian economics. It's a break with regulation, welfare, state measures. It's an attempt to provide the capitalist class with unregulated activity, which means they could sign free trade agreements that prejudiced employment, that prejudiced local manufacturers, that allowed, above all, for major banks and multinationals to move offshore and avoid taxation and undercut local wages. Neoliberalism also included the deregulation of banking and the allowing banks to engage in speculation, even on deposit accounts at banks. So we have the exit of the regulations from the Roosevelt administration of the 30s. So, in effect, what neoliberalism is the concentration and centralization of power in the business elite. It is the bailing out of large-scale speculators on Wall Street, the major banks, and the transfer of enormous sums of taxpayer money into the accounts of speculators and investors who did not take into account the chaos of market activity. It has nothing to do with any liberal ideas about freedom for workers to organize unions and of workers to have access to health and public services. It's the opposition of the idea of a free country because, in a sense, we are always captive of the movements of capital across national boundaries and across the tax zones of our country. So essentially, neoliberalism is the breakdown of community in the United States, the breakdown of an industrial economy. It is the breakdown of any sense of responsibility for employment, welfare, and American integrity.
Jim Petras, 2016 has been a year of major upheavals in the United States. We've had a man who calls himself a democratic socialist running in the primaries. The threat of nuclear war with Russia is terrifyingly present. The rising popular anger is quite extraordinary. What are your thoughts about the situation as we're now?
Well, I think the Obama and Clinton administrations, if we can combine them, engaged in a whole series of major military confrontations despite their claims to be against wars. They heightened U.S. military involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. They escalated U.S. military involvement in Libya and Syria, as heightened U.S. military buildups of nuclear weapons on the Russian border against all the agreements that were made 20 years ago, and more recently has been involved in building up a naval armada off the Chinese coast and threatening to undermine China's important role in the world economy. So we can say from one end of the world to the other, the U.S. has surrendered its economic coexistence, political coexistence with adversaries, rivals, competitors, or even allies, and built up a military machine which is costly to the U.S. consumers but has been a boon to American military complex.
We're speaking with Professor James Petras, the author of the just-published book, The End of the Republic and the Delusion of Empire, a terrific book that I urge all of our listeners to read. Jim, you speak at one part of the book about the Democratic Party, and you raise two questions that I'd like to ask you. One is, why have mass movements been unable to break with the Democratic Party, and how does the Democratic Party able to retain the support of the electorate?
Well, I think one of the faults here, or several of them, is the trade unions in the United States have surrendered their independence, and most of the high-paid six-digit salary trade union officials have become tools of the Democratic Party, independently of the fact that their membership has declined from 30% of the labor force to 7%. The second thing is that many dissidents, from Jesse Jackson to Kucinich to Obama to Sanders, mobilized people on the basis of seemingly very progressive agendas, but in the run-up to the elections, they capitulate and become shepherds for the Democratic Party. So whatever dissidents we know, peace movements, civil liberties movements, civil rights movements, labor movements, are mobilized, but they're then channeled into the Democratic Party among the dissidents, and then the dissidents cave in and hand over their voters or their supporters to the Democratic Party establishment. So that's hindered. People have not understood the need to break with the dissidents and leftists that stay in the Democratic Party and the need to form an independent party, a party that represents working people minorities and immigrants and other groups that have played an important role in pressuring for change. Look what happened to the peace movements that stood up against Bush and then against Obama and then subsequently caved in and now left homeless. They either have to stand with Clinton, who's a notorious warmonger, who has been involved in some of the bloodiest wars that the U.S. has engaged in the past few years. The one that draws $400,000 lectures for speaking for Goldman Sachs on Wall Street. Now you have Bernie Sanders backing one of the most notorious warmongers, which discredits Sanders to some degree, but leaves all those voters and activists without a home.
Well, what do you say to people like Noam Chomsky, who say that Trump is so evil, so unpredictable, that given the choice between Hillary Clinton and Trump, you have to vote for Trump. What do you say to people who put forward that argument?
Well, I think it's a politics of senility. I hate to say this, but if you look at the record, it's Hillary Clinton who launched into the million people casualties in the wars against the Iraqi people. It's Hillary Clinton and the Clintons who undermined the constraints on banking speculation. It's Hillary Clinton who has committed the U.S. to a war confrontation with Russia, who stimulated and fostered the coup in the Ukraine, and who has been at the forefront of threatening a nuclear war with China. I don't see that Trump has done anything comparable to that, though I would not exclude it. He's rhetorically on the same wavelength with Clinton, but she's done it. He stayed on the sidewise, and I think it's a discredit to Chomsky. I don't think anybody should take him serious because what he says has no relevance to the actualities in the world. His rant against Trump should be directed at Hillary Clinton. But again, you have to say to Chomsky that you've been wrong on a number of issues. You've been wrong on the importance of the Zionists in shaping U.S. policy to Israel. You have been wrong in looking at the changes in Latin America. You have been wrong in trying to understand the boycott and divestment movement regarding opposition to Israel settlements in the West Bank. You are opposed to the return of expelled Palestinians. So I think this isn't the first time that Chomsky's been wrong. He's been wrong on a number of major issues. The fact that he uses a very hostile rhetoric to the U.S. doesn't preclude his capitulating on strategic issues like the elections this year.
Why and how do you believe that Obama is racing towards establishing his imperial legacy?
Well, because he's been discredited in many ways. I mean, he supposedly was a historic figure for a black president, and blacks are worse off than they were when he first came into office. The inequalities between whites and blacks has increased. The income of black workers has declined. The immigration issue is still up in the air. Over 2 million Mexican Americans and Latinos have been expelled under his presidency. He's been a disaster, and now he's attempting through these new policies to make up for it, but he does so in a very belligerent way. So whatever he says about peace and recognition doesn't carry any ice. It's a war against Putin. It's a war against China. And he doesn't succeed. China's trade is booming in Asia. The U.S. is on the sidelines. U.S. is trying to build up a wall against Russia, and the Western Europeans, especially the Germans, are opening ties, gas and oil ties with Russia. So we're talking about a loser who hasn't recognized his losses.
We're speaking with Professor James Petras, the author of the just-released book, The End of the Republic and the Delusion of Empire. Jim, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you one final question. Why is empire a delusion?
Because the U.S. has not been able to recognize the changes in world politics. Russia is not a feeble, a destroyed country as it was in the 90s. Putin has reformulated and reconstructed Russia as a potent state. The U.S. fails to recognize it cannot dominate Asia as it did at the end of World War II. It has to share power. It has to come to terms with the trade agreements with China. It has been a total failure in trying to establish its control over the Middle East. We see the growth of ISIS and the constant retreat of the U.S. in major fields. And so instead of coming to terms and recognizing the limitations of U.S. power, the fact the world has changed, Washington is not in a position to engage in wars and provide for living standards in the United States. The need now to lessen overseas military commitments and to rebuild the American economy is foremost, and that means turning back to the Republic and foreseeing illusions and delusions of empire.
Jim Petras, thank you so much. Your new book is a wonderful volume. It's called The End of the Republic and the Delusion of Empire by Professor James Petras. We urge our listeners to get a hold of this book and read it closely. And Jim, it's been good to have you back on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to interviewing you again. Thank you so much.
An excellent job, Michael. You've really been hitting the mark, especially on the law and disorder stuff.
Thanks so much. You take it easy.
Yeah, bye.
Last 2 weeks, the police have killed 41 people. Five police were killed in Dallas and three others in Baton Rouge by two African-American military veterans. Black Lives Matter, a nonviolent nationwide group seeking to abolish police abuse, has been attacked by the police, the media, and politicians as facilitating terrorism. We're joined today by human rights activist and former political science professor Ajamu Baraka. He is on the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Baraka writes for the Black Agenda Report. Ajamu Baraka, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure to be here, Michael.
Ajamu, in the last 2 weeks alone, 41 people have been killed by the police. Eight people were shot by African-American veterans in Dallas and in Baton Rouge. The media, politicians, and the police have been working overtime to try to blame Black Lives Matter for this and saying that they're facilitating terrorism. How do you assess the state of the movement today?
You know, Michael, we have entered a very serious period in the U.S. where there's an attempt to criminalize the police and state violence. This gap between legitimate protests, the legitimate expression of speech, of opposition to the tactics of the state, and the category of being a threat to the state, that gap has been reduced. There seems to be an effort to silence critics of the state. So it's a very dangerous environment that's being created both by police unions and police spokespersons, and even by elements of the press. But the what we see in terms of the emerging movement is a persistence that is, luckily, the intimidation factor has not resulted in a reduction in opposition. In fact, today, July 21st, there are national actions around the country to continue to put pressure and to bring attention to this ongoing war that's being waged against the black community, black working class people. And actually, for many of us, we are raising the issue that that war is also being waged against Latinos, Native folks, and even members of the white working class. So this continues, but it continues in an environment that's becoming increasingly repressive.
What demands are being raised now by the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, the demands appear to be a call for measures of community control of the police. Some are making the argument that there should be an immediate halt to the 1033 program, that program where surplus military hardware is transferred from military branches to local police forces. Some people are calling for the defunding of the police. The demands are somewhat diffused. Today, the demands seem to be focused on questioning the continued support by the police unions. But one of the things that has to happen in terms of this emerging movement is more focused demands, I believe, on the federal authorities in a way in which people are very clear about what those demands are. I mean, for example, the Department of Justice seems to have gotten a free ride, a pass, that, if you will. There's only been one indictment of one of these killer cops over the last few years, despite video evidence that suggests that people's civil rights have been violated. Department of Justice will initiate an investigation that seems to be endless. So I think that the focus has to be on the federal government in terms of its non-prosecutions. The federal government has a responsibility to review, for example, the rules around the use of deadly force to see if they have discriminatory impact. There are a number of things that the federal government could be doing to try to bring these local police forces into line and have them to comply with international human rights standards related to how they engage in policing. But those kind of demands have not been crystallized yet.
One of the people who shot and killed several police officers was later referred to by a black woman as a martyr. And I had a lot of sympathy with that definition, although I thought that he should have chosen another path. What was your reaction?
Well, there is a split in the African-American community in terms of how one should look at these two young men. Some people are saying that these two young men are, in fact, part of our community, that even if one did not agree with their actions, it's understandable that especially for ex-military personnel who have themselves been traumatized by their experiences in the military and being placed in military and in combat situations, that to be bombarded almost daily with these images of war being waged against black people, that it might trigger that kind of reaction. So taking that into account, the question is, do we just sort of ignore and reject, exclude these individuals from our community? And some people are saying that we should not. They may not go that far and to call them martyrs, but it's a legitimate conversation. That doesn't negate the fact that lives have been lost, and everybody's lives are precious. But Many people argue that we cannot elevate the value of the life of police who are trusted with the responsibility of theoretically protecting and serving the public, in which that trust seems to be violated on a daily basis when it comes to black people. We can't, you know, elevate the value of their lives above the lives of the people who have been the victim of forces that have a monopoly over the use of violence. So it is, I think, a legitimate conversation, but it's a polarizing one also.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that one could say that these shootings of police officers are wrong, not just because taking a life is wrong, but also because it allows the media and the politicians and the police to put the onus of violence on us and not on them, where it truly belongs. And secondly, I think, and really fundamentally, I think it's a mistake for individuals to substitute their actions for the actions of people in a mass movement from below. Lesson that we've learned is that social change comes from mass movements from below, and that's what we should concentrate on. What's your reaction to those observations?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and that's why a disciplined movement would not necessarily be engaged in that kind of individualized, anger sort of driven reaction that we saw from those two young men. And we know that the state will attempt to capitalize off of those actions to tighten repression against the movement before it's able to really develop itself. So, and we see that happening already. We see that they have used this moment, those two incidents, to delegitimize legitimate opposition. And so, yeah, those kinds of actions, and we've all been through this before, will be capitalized by the state to try to intimidate and silence opposition and to undermine what we have to be engaged in, which is really organizing as opposed to just these protest activities. So, again, this is, a reflection of the weaknesses of our movement. It's a reflection of folks are just upset and angry and who want to resist engaging in individualized actions. But at the same time, Michael, you know, again, it's sort of understandable that kind of reaction would emerge. I mean, the trauma of being exposed to this war being waged against folks is something that, in fact, could be triggering. I mean, especially when you look at the fact that some of these veterans are still suffering from post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the other aspect of this that we need to raise is that it invites repression against the movement. Yes. On the part of the police, and in that sense is counterproductive.
Yes, yes, there's no question about that, and that's what I alluded to a moment ago, that it does give them an opportunity to increase the repression, even though we know that the repression is going to come anyway and that they will use other excuses to do that. In fact, they have been moving legally in that direction for the last decade. But this kind of activity does open up the door to allow them to not only increase repression, but to separate the movement from the public, from its potential popular base. And that is something that's really of concern. And that's why the movement that's developing has to figure out ways to frame his opposition in such a way where it doesn't allow itself to be politically isolated. And that's why some of us are concerned about the lack of clear language that moves the issue of police and state violence out of the framework of just being a race contradiction to one in which the nature of the state, the role of the state, the class basis of the state is ignored. We have to begin to move to a more sophisticated political assessment that allows not only the proper analysis, but allows for us to build the kind of political movement that's multinational and more effective than what we see developing right now.
If people want to stay in touch with you, Ajama, can you give us some help here on your websites? How do people get a hold of Black Agenda Report, for example, or stay in touch with the Center for Constitutional Rights or Black Lives Matter?
Well, I would say that I think folks, everyone who is progressive, who's interested in the opinions and debates among Black progressives and Black leftists, should be reading Black Agenda Report. I write for that on a regular basis. So blackagendareport.com is someplace that you should read. They can go to my website, which is basically ajamubaraka.com. I would encourage people to go to the pages of Counterpunch, all any of the alternative press in which you have a consistent progressive analysis is important, especially at this critical moment in history.
Well, thank you, Ajamu Baraka. We've run out of our allotted time, but we're really grateful that you tore yourself out of a meeting and talked with us here on Law and Disorder. You take it easy and good luck.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Cleveland at the Republican National Convention with the delegates, the media, and the protesters is something truly to behold. We catch up with Arun Gupta to get his impressions on what it's like to be in Cleveland during the notorious Republican National Convention. Arun, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on today, Michael.
Well, Arun, I want to find out from you. You've been out on the streets of Cleveland. I've been watching your live feeds. I've been reading your articles. It's really been extraordinary. And I wanted to ask you, for you, what some of the high points and low points have been being out there at the Republican National Convention. My high point, I have to say, was Tiffany Trump's speech, where she said essentially, "I love my dad. He gave me a pony. Vote for him."
Well, you know, I think that's great. But out here on the streets is Vermin Supreme. I'd say he's my high point. He's a perennial presidential candidate, a satirist, wears a boot on his head. And he says every election, "I'll give everyone a pony." So, you know, Trump may have just given a pony to Tiffany Trump, but Vermin Supreme says he's going to give everyone a pony. So I'm with Vermin.
What do you make about what's going on there? You've been interviewing Trump people across the country, and now you've got them all in one place. I have to say it's a frightening vision, wearing shirts that look like American flags and waving straw cowboy hats and chanting USA, USA. It's kind of mindless and hate-filled and scary. What's been your impression?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's really important to remember is I think the left is often very non-dialectical, that they see Trump as just an expression of racism and white nationalism that already exists. But in fact, what he's done is he's helped consolidate it, right? He's helped kind of synthesize a new, deeper, broader reaction. He's made it okay to be racist. His whole thing, like I've heard from so many Trump supporters, he sounds like us. He's not politically correct. And what they really mean is, like, I no longer have to feel guilty about being a racist, about a bigot, about being a sexist. In fact, you're trying to shut down my free speech. And so it's actually really destructive. And I think what the real danger is there's a lot of complacency, especially among liberals. You know, Trump could very well win, despite all one would need volumes to just, like, really cover every just horrendous thing that he said or has been done in this campaign. And yet he still remains within striking distance in key swing states, in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida. He is basically tied. Hillary Clinton is barely ahead. Now, this is a complicated issue because it also has to do with the Democratic Party basically kicking the white working class in the face that really began with the Clintons and policies like ending welfare, mass incarceration, and most of all NAFTA and Wall Street deregulation. But the Trump phenomena is very scary, and the fact, despite he is such just a horrendous human being in every way, that he still has so much support should be a wake-up call, because even if Trump loses, Trumpism will survive this election.
I think that's very, very true. And as horrific as he is, he's an unknown and really frightening quantity as a president. But Hillary Clinton is a known quantity as a Secretary of State and as a partner with her husband Bill for all those years. And that's an equally frightening thing to contemplate. What do you think about that?
Well, both of them are uniquely dangerous. They have, and here's the way I summarize it. Trump would be worse for brown people, workers, and women inside the United States, and the poor. Hillary Clinton would be worse for workers, brown people, the poor, and women outside the United States. She is an absolute warmonger, and she pushes every free trade deal imaginable. I ran into Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the much loathed chair of the DNC, yesterday on the street, so right outside the convention. And I asked her, why are you here, Representative Schultz? And she says, I'm here to, you know, deliver the response that Hillary Clinton's message is better than Donald Trump's. And so when I started asking her about that message, well, what do you think of Hillary Clinton's support of free trade deals? She refused to answer. What do you think of Hillary Clinton's support for wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and pretty much every other country? And she refused to answer. So, you know, let's not fool ourselves. Hillary Clinton is an absolutely atrocious candidate. People, the left in particular, should be organizing to oppose whoever's in power. It should not be playing these games about, oh, you need to support Clinton or vote for Jill Stein or vote. This is all irrelevant. The left really needs to be building movements. And, you know, it's really sad how the police and FBI were able to really scare off everyone from Cleveland. There's just an absolute absurdity to the spectacle, and it's nothing but spectacle. You'll see these protest marches where there's just a couple dozen people, and there's this huge swirl, hundreds of medias. All you can see are these cameras held aloft above them, just photographing everything, hundreds of media. And then around them are like 500 cops, just this massive deployment. It's going to get to the point where you know, a few elections down the road, there'll just be one guy holding two signs, one that says, yay, our side, and the other says, boo, their side. And there'll be 1,000 media around him and 5,000 cops. This is what American democracy has become.
Really is ludicrous. We're kind of running out of our allotted time, Arun. Do you want to share with us any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
Well, I'll be at the DNC in Philadelphia next week. You know, it does look like there will be more protests there. But again, it looks more like an anti-Clinton Sandinistas type protest. And, you know, I would just really say to folks, like, you know, they need to take this energy from the Bernie Sanders campaign. I was always skeptical because it was clear he would endorse Clinton. And they need to take it and put it into independent movement building. That is the only way anything ever changes. Not following Bernie and trying to get these progressive candidates elected. It's by supporting things like Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, the climate justice movement, low-wage worker organizing. That's what changes politics.
I'll say. Arun, if our listeners want to follow your reports in Philadelphia, how do people get a hold of you?
Well, currently everything, I'm reporting from both conventions for Telesaur English, which you can just Google up. I'm live streaming often up to a couple hours a day. You know, those are really fun because I'm videoing what's going on, offering commentary, interviewing people. I had a really absurd encounter with Don King. Don King from, I think you might have seen that, Michael. Don King is from Cleveland. Donald Trump really wanted to have him speak at the convention.
Tell our listeners why he was not a good choice, what he did.
50 years ago, almost exactly 50 years ago, Don King stomped a man to death on the streets of Cleveland. Don King is just, I mean, the guy is really sharp. He's very quick on his feet. He's 84 years old, and he's a verbal pugilist. But he stole $1 million from Muhammad Ali. He has deep ties to the mob. So, you know, it probably wouldn't look good to have a guy speaking to the audience who stomped a man to death. And I asked him about that, and he said, I have suffered deep contrition for this. I have deep contrition for this. But he immediately flipped to portraying himself as a victim, which is a classic right strategy. They are always the victim. He said, this just goes to show how stand your ground laws do not apply to black men. There are two standards here. So him stomping a man to death, he's the victim. Then when I asked him about the allegations he stole $1 million from Muhammad Ali, the crowd that had gathered around this manhandled me, and security moved in to try and push me away. But I kept asking him questions about his mob ties, and he was just like, allegations, you know. So it's you can find that on Telesaur English. It's a pretty fun little encounter, you know. There's a lot of bigwigs out here, and the media don't ask the hard questions. The media don't go out in the neighborhood. You know, let's remember that Cleveland was ground zero for the home foreclosure crisis. The African-American community here was absolutely devastated, and Trump was implicated in that with his Trump University and his real estate forces. You've got something like 11,000 media, and they're not going out in the neighborhood. They're just covering this farce inside, which is a tale told by an idiot, a sound and fury about nothing.
Arun Gupta, you're a courageous and really fine journalist. Keep up the good work, and we'll try to get a hold of you when you get down to Philadelphia. You take it easy, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Michael. We'll look forward to it.
Today, the Republican National Convention in Cleveland is winding down. There's been an overwhelming police presence there. Police on horses, police on bicycles, police on foot, police in trucks. 1,900 police living in dormitories on the campus of Case Western Reserve. Militarized police armed with army surplus weapons, even artillery. We speak today with Chris Hermes, an activist and former staffer at the National Lawyers Guild. Chris is the author of a book published last year called Crashing the Party, Legacies and Lessons from the RNC 2000. RNC 2000, when the Republicans met in Philadelphia, was a turning point in policing of large demonstrations. Its hallmarks were denial of protest permits to thwart protest planning, sweeping exclusionary zones, interrogation of activists, unlawful stop and search of activists, preemptive raids, widespread violence, mass arrests, long detentions, high bail, overcharging, and denying access to legal counsel. Chris is in Cleveland where we speak with him about the situation as it's unfolded in that city and what we're likely to expect when the Democrats meet in Philadelphia. Chris Hermes, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you, a veteran of several days on the streets of Cleveland during the RNC, and you've been to every RNC since the year 2000, so we salute you for that. And let me ask you this. Describe what it's like out there in Cleveland during the Republican National Convention.
Well, it's unfortunately like a police state in downtown Cleveland right now and has been over the past several days. We've seen police come out in massive shows of force. We have probably more than two dozen different police agencies from around the country, from Florida, Texas, California, you name it, there are police agencies here helping out in the effort to really control the level of dissent going on in the streets. We have police officers with automatic weapons. We have riot gear. We have police with bicycles that are using them as crowd control devices, as barricades, and they're using their bikes to push back against large crowds of people. And just yesterday, we saw a constitutionally protected flag burning be really swarmed by dozens and dozens of police officers who aggressively arrested more than a dozen folks who are currently in jail trying to get out.
Have people been able, the protesters there, have they been able to get their message out so the media can pick it up? How effective have the police been in suppressing opposition?
Well, just the fact that police are chilling dissent and in large part preventing people from even coming to the streets, the message is being stifled in that way. However, the people who are out in the streets are getting their message across the best they can. I should also point out that we heard about reports of multiple FBI raids yesterday, in which federal agents came to the homes of activists and questioned them, entered without a warrant, without consent. So we see intimidation playing out in a number of ways, and perhaps that's how they are frightening activists, protesters, and the public alike. Keeping the messages somewhat suppressed, but I'm heartened by the number of people I've seen out in the streets, unwilling to be intimidated, and marching and demonstrating regardless.
How are the lawyers and legal workers and National Lawyers Guild people, how are they organized and what are they doing?
Well, we've got a legal office set up that includes dispatched legal observers, which include people who are monitoring police misconduct and who's getting arrested on the streets. We have a hotline that are taking calls from legal observers on the streets, as well as people from inside jail once they've been arrested. And we've got a long list of pro bono criminal defense attorneys that are sitting ready to take cases if they're indeed prosecuted. So we've got a very robust legal support effort here in Cleveland right now, and we're very excited to be able to support these political movements who are demonstrating in the streets.
Well, as a veteran, Chris, of all these Republican National Conventions, can you give me some of the highlights for you, personal highlights and personal low points that you've seen in the last several days?
Well, the protests themselves have been less populated than other political conventions I've provided legal support for in the past. But they're just as fierce, and people are certainly opposed to a Trump presidency and want to do everything they can to push back against the establishment and the Republican Party. I've seen a repeat of history, frankly, in the lead-up to the convention with restriction of free speech activity that was challenged by the ACLU, incidentally, successfully. But we still have an overwhelming show of force. We still have police who are aggressively attacking protesters and being unwilling to tolerate even the most mild actions like marches and, as I mentioned, flag burnings. I've been inside a legal office most of the time I've been in Cleveland, so I don't have a lot to report from the streets, but I'm very happy to be working with fellow legal workers, law students, and lawyers to make sure everybody is adequately supported and represented.
Chris Hermes, it's really heartening to hear the good work that you and the other folks are doing in Cleveland. You're going to be taking the show on the road to Philadelphia for the Democrats. And what do you anticipate in Philadelphia?
Well, it's really hard to say. I think Philadelphia has a sordid history when it comes to responding to political protest. At least at the turn of the century, there was a tremendous amount of repression that happened on the streets and in the jails and subsequently in the courtrooms. I don't know if it's going to play out the same way this time. Certainly there were fewer arrests here in Cleveland than what we've seen at previous Republican convention protests. I'm hoping that continues. I'm hoping law enforcement sees the virtue of respecting people's First Amendment rights and allow them to demonstrate without controlling the protests and without arresting massive numbers of people. We'll see what happens. We've also got a legal support system set up, including a legal collective in Philadelphia called Up Against the Law. And we've also got the National Lawyers Guild chapter in Philadelphia dispatching legal observers and making sure that police misconduct is documented well in the streets.
Now, if our listeners plan to be in Philadelphia and need some help, do you have a number or a website that you want to share with us?
Well, we've got a website with jail hotline numbers that can be dialed at any time. And you can get that number by going online and looking up the website for Up Against the Law or the National Lawyers Guild Philadelphia chapter.
Thank you so much, Chris Hermes. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder, and thanks for doing the great work that you're doing in Cleveland and Philadelphia. Good luck.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Take care.
You too.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
And getting larger all the time. A whirlpool spell disaster for all the people who don't rhyme. Him who don't fit through the needle's eye. Him who just don't understand. Spent for killing. Seems the whole world must be dying. All the children who go hungry. How much food we could be buying. Him who don't fit through the needle's eye.
behind. People wake up every morning and simply push their lives aside. They seem to carry all their feelings crushed and crumpled up inside. My father, many questions on my mind, but he didn't want to answer me. God, the whole world must be blind. Him who don't fit through the needle's eye, you may someday go insane. Insane. Of freedom.